The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. This week, Victor Moon breaks your heart and sorely tries Billy May's patience. There are sweet memories of Kuala Lumpur and sweet memories of Engelbert, plus a Surrey with a fringe on top going at a hell of a lick. Mark Stein, On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. September 11th. September 11th. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, 9 p.m. in Paris, 10 p.m. in Kiev. What was it that guy was asking Trump last night? Did he not want Ukraine to win or whatever it was? 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran in solidarity with the half-hour time zone. 11:30 p.m. in Kabul, where the regime that hosted the 9/11 plotters laughs at the shock and awe of the global superpower. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers. 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne. 7 a.m. in Auckland. And a rather more convivial hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominion across the Pacific. When we launched this website in 2002, we did annual commemorations of September 11th, the day the world changed in the cliche of the era. We ceased our observances 7 years ago because the war is lost at home and abroad. On the domestic front, we doubled the rate of Muslim immigration to the West and began assimilating ourselves with Islam's strictures on freedom of expression and the like. The nearly two decades since the Danish Muhammad cartoons has been one long remorseless surrender on core Western liberties. When a school teacher gets beheaded in the street, there is no outrage at the act, just a mild regret that he should have been foolish enough to provoke his own fate. And even the milder jokes from the immediate post-9/11 era, the cartoon of the woman in my own newspaper, The Daily Telegraph, trying on new burqas in the changing room and wondering, does my bomb look big in this? Those cartoons would not be published today. My book would not be published today. America and its allies turned out to be profoundly unserious. There are honourable ways to lose a war. This has not been one of them. We have dishonoured the dead of 9/11 and insulted their sacrifice. The world moves on. As Kamala likes to say, we're not going back. I flew in for the debate. I was in rural England over the weekend for a reunion of some old chums from the broadcasting world, some of whom I hadn't seen in decades, one of whom I hadn't seen in half a century. I enjoyed it very much while also feeling, as I've felt everywhere in the COVID era these last 4 years, that I was seeing the place for the last time. I felt that in parts of America. I felt that in the UK. I felt that all over Europe. I stayed in an inn, the same inn that Guy Fawkes had stayed in whatever it was, 1604, 1605, to plot the blowing up of Parliament. And I don't know whether I was staying in the same room he actually stayed in. Maybe I should have plotted to blow up Parliament. Somebody needs to. Somebody needs to. And I kept glancing round the room to see which were the parliamentary plotters planning to blow the joint sky high with a new gunpowder plot. But that's pretty much how I felt. Headline of then, of course, I hopped on the plane because I'd been told I was obligated to return to far northern New Hampshire so I could watch this awful debate. Headline of the day from the Babylon Bee: Democrats to replace Kamala on ballot with ABC moderators. they're more brazen than they... I mean, they were always biased. But, you know, at a certain level, it's gotten worse over the last 10, 15 years, whatever it is. Because you go back to the early years of this century and chaps like Bob Schieffer genuinely thought that he was... And he was a... down-the-line Democrat on every conceivable issue, but he thought of himself as a person able to be impartial. There was no pretense of that from these awful people last night, and I don't even know why anyone bothers with them. They're not... I mean, if you compare them just to the audiences that guys like Bob Schieffer and Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and whoever used to get 20 years ago... They were big. You know, these guys like David Muir can walk around the streets and not be recognized at all. So I don't even know. I don't know why it's necessary to play along with that anymore. But, you know, increasingly, left and right inhabit different worlds. And so there's no point them, if they're going to intersect for 90 minutes every 4 years, it shouldn't just be on the left's terms. Rachel Aronoff is our first questioner today. She says, "Dear Mark, what did you make of..." And I do apologise, I've got a bit of vocal strain going on here. Rachel Aronoff says, "Dear Mark, what did you make of Kamala saying that she and Tim each have guns? That comment surprised me. Is she lying? Why would she say that?" Yes, she announced herself as a gun owner toward the end of yesterday's show. Let's put it this way. I'd be interested to know when she acquired the gun. But I think this is just the thing. You know, it's like the same, like her pledge to turn the United States military, which is a disaster, into the most lethal fighting force in the world. There's basically three reactions to that. There's people who think... there's people who don't believe her. There's people who think she's serious, you know, youth, idealistic youth, who are disgusted by the remark. And then there's other Democrats who know she doesn't mean it. It's like Obama saying that marriage is between a man and a woman. There's just something she has to say when you're 2 months out from the election. And buying a gun when you're 2 months out from the election. When she said it, I was wondering if it was like her, which has been dropped, quietly dropped. It was like her insistence that she'd worked as a burger flipper in McDonald's, which is non-operative, apparently. They've quietly dropped that one. And I was thinking the gun ownership might fall into that category. And of course, the thing is, Trump didn't have a very good night. But if he should have just turned to her and actually said, oh, yeah, what make? Because that would have been like the Nikki Haley being asked to name the provinces in Ukraine that are inviolably Ukrainian and that the Russians shouldn't be allowed to take. That would have just been one of the, oh, yeah, what make is it? Right. But I don't know what make and what model. I don't know what she's I think this is closer on reflection to John Kerry going into that store in Iowa in the run-up to the 2004 election and going, where can I get me a hunting license? You know, that this is how Democrats have to run or feel they have to run. It's infuriating. She was basically, she touted the endorsement of Cheney. I bet she wouldn't mind, I bet at certain moments she wouldn't mind firing Waltz and running on a Harris-Cheney ticket. He's tanned, rested and ready. This is just how Democrats, she's running, it's interesting to me, she's running like a Democrat from 20 years ago or from the 90s. When you in the 90s, when you used to watch the American political ads, you couldn't tell whether the guy was a Republican or a Democrat because they'd all, I'm going to get tough on crime and I'm, you know. And so I think it falls more into that category. Rachel continues, it's frustrating that righties couldn't anticipate that Kamala would do a very decent job. We know she is trainable. In fact, she sounded like she was trained by Obama's trainer. you make her sound like horses one regrets buying, but you hope to do a decent enough job to get them through the 2,000 guineas at Newmarket or the Queen's Plate in Toronto or whatever. Trump was unprepared with substance and talking points, but I think his greatest handicap is that people tell him not to be himself, as if you can strain out his weaknesses, says Rachel, and be left with his strengths. Stifled Trump becomes a rump. Well, I'm sympathetic because yesterday was just like a complete racket. You know, he has his jokes fact-checked. He has everything. He has his father's record as a real estate landlord fact-checked. You know, so we're talking about, what decade was that? The 1940s? So they're prepared to go for Trump for whatever his dad did in the middle years of the last century, but they won't, quote-unquote, fact-checked Kamala on what she said 18 months ago. You know, as I said, I don't know, I don't see the point of putting up with it. And it's gotten worse. I mean, you know, I said that Bob Schieffer wasn't like these guys are now. And in fairness, in those days, going back 10, 15 years or whatever, like my old radio pal, Hugh Hewitt, they used to have Hugh on the panel, the moderator's panel. He didn't get to ask many questions, but it wasn't as brazen as this stuff is these days. Joe says, if you listen to how Kamala Harris spoke last night at the debate, maybe swing your eyes a little and look away from the screen and listen closely to her prepared and rehearsed responses. Do you hear some similarities to Obama's voice? Specifically when she says, some folks, let's be clear, hard-working folk, middle-class kid, lifting people up and not beating people down. I'm wondering if Harris's speechwriter is the same as Obama's. Now, again, I think this is just how they talk on the when you're 2 months out from an election, because they can't talk about her. She can't say, yeah, I was proud to support Black Lives Matter and contribute to funds to get him out of jail and pay their bail and all that kind of thing. She can't actually be honest about who she is. And I don't actually even know who she is, really. I don't know who I am, because I've lived in a lot of different countries, and according to what time of day you catch me, various bits of my past are sort of jostling to be uppermost. But she never talks honestly about what it was like to go to the most prestigious high school in Westmount, when she was in Montreal, and talk about it. And the stuff she says, you know, about claiming to have celebrated Kwanzaa in the province of Quebec. The needs of politics today invariably throw up people who are good at being fakers. And sometimes they're so good at being fakers, there's no, you know, it's like, since I brought up Quebec, a couple of years ago, there's a friend of mine who hosts a show on telly in Quebec, En Direct de l'Univers, Live from the Universe. It's a live music show where it's done as a tribute to a star each week, and people who are important in the star's life come on and sing songs about them. And the one I was thinking of was from a couple of years, and I love, it's sad really, because I always very much enjoy, if I'm in town, going along and sitting in the audience. Anyway, a couple of years back, it was Celine Dion that they were paying tribute to on the show. And her best friend from high school in Laval, just north of Montreal, came on and sang You've Got a Friend. And it was very moving, and Celine was in tears and all the rest of it. Do you know something? Aside from sending James Taylor to Paris to sing You've Got a Friend to the French after some or other massacre, there are no friends of Barack Obama who turn up and sing You've Got a Friend at some Barack Obama tribute night. There's nobody from people he was at school with. Nobody from the people he was in Indonesia with. And likewise, nobody turns up from Westmount High School or wherever to sing You've Got a Friend about Kamala. These are people who have these are people who they must have biographies, but almost all the real matter in their lives has been systematically excluded. It's very weird. That's why you get weird people in your politics. Fearless Freep says, how can anyone call last night's debate a win for Trump? Kamala Harris is no Cicero, but she was at least prepped and coached, and so did not stumble in any big way. Trump seemed unprepared, like due to an arrogant refusal to rehearse, given his ego. This will be another hole punched in his canoe. Well, we don't know about that. There's some survey of undecided voters, which is a bizarre category in these days. But the undecided voters apparently went 6-3, according to Reuters, went 6-3 for Trump with one undecided. You don't know how you know, there's a lot of what they now call gaslighting going on. And one of them is the insistence that Trump wasn't good last night, but she wasn't good either. She didn't say anything. She didn't answer any questions. And the brazenness of the moderators may be such that people get that, you know, the game is rigged. So I don't know whether, and it's weird. Well, let's put it this way: it's weird to have a question asked about January the 6th, for example. You know, they get Kamala keeps going, oh, I'm all about the future. I'm not looking back. We're not going back and all the rest. A lot of the questions are about things that are absolutely ancient. Like the January 6th thing where the court, he again, you know, got detoured into his own situation. The situation to talk about is the ones from these recent Supreme Court decisions where they just keep striking down the laws that were used by the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice. That's another one. I hope there's Guy Fawkes' American cousin is plotting to blow up that joint. You know, That's corrupt from top to toe. And the Supreme Court keeps ruling that this or that law that was used to convict them doesn't apply in this case. You know, but we don't get a question. We get a question on January the 6th. We don't get a question about the ongoing FBI investigation into how it was that a guy was able to put a bullet. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he had a graphic about immigration, and he tilted his head by an eighth of an inch, he'd be dead. And it's been memory hold. He brought it up. It never looks good when you have to bring up the fact that you were almost killed yourself, you know, because nobody else does it. But this whole frame, I can't stand it, because it's worse than in any other country. It's what it really is. I don't like the BBC. I don't like the CBC. I don't like the ABC in Australia. But the framing, the brazen Democrat framing, you know, that's why it's a that's why that thing's a pretty funny line. You know, Democrats. What was it from the Babylon Bee? Democrats to replace Kamala on ballot with ABC moderators. He didn't do a. You know, I'm sympathetic to Trump because he was a rich guy who took a decision a decade ago now, almost 9 years ago, that he'd like to end his long and highly lucrative career, not just posing with showgirls and hosting telly shows. He'd like to do something for his country. And because he's from outside the set, the approved set, he wasn't an ideological guy. You know, he basically changed his position on abortion because instead of palling around with New York liberals, Hollywood liberals all week long, he was now palling around with various social conservatives who are critical to the Republican base. We all know that. We all know that. But he wanted to do something for his country. And as a result, he's been indicted, he's been convicted, and he's been shot. He had got a bullet in his head. And the lousy, garbage American media doesn't care about it. The Onion's doing jokes about Cory Comparatore, who had to be carried out in a body bag. From that rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. He's dead because in the garbage pseudo-republic of America, he went to a political rally and he's dead. And Americans should be deeply ashamed at that. And they should be horrified at what, you know, there's some good reporters out there who are following all this stuff, like Sean Davis, I think he owns the Federalist, or he's the publisher or whatever he is over there. But he's following. It's absolutely extraordinary what the Secret Service allowed to happen. The only good things. And then they lie about it. The first guy to put a bullet into the would-be assassin was the local guy from, I don't forget whether it's the sheriff's department or it's the municipal police or whatever. But it's the despised local constabulary that, because the other guys were sitting, the Secret Service, the big shots, are all sitting around watching the guy put bullets into, at the stage. And it's only, and they don't act. They only act after the local copper, you know, Constable Bloggs, thinks, oh, yeah, that guy's shooting, and puts a bullet in him. And then they lie about it afterwards. You know, I'm bitter about what's happened to me. I can't imagine how Trump feels. Bill Holcomb says, hi, Mark. Do you agree that Mr. Trump's most unfortunate moment in the debate was his tragic devaluation of the key campaign issue, illegal immigration, with his eating dogs and cats tirade? Not only did he depreciate the political power of the issue, he gave a magnificent gift to the Saturday Night Live writing staff. Surely pet consumption was not included as a debate prep topic. Well, again, I'm kind of sympathetic to that because animals are being the salient. I wrote about this town. I've never been to this town, to the best of my knowledge. Springfield, Ohio. It's a town of about 58,000. With a normal Ohioan demographic that's now been swelled to 80,000, over 25% of whom are Haitian, quote-unquote, refugees under this temporary protected status, temporary meaning, you know, the equivalent of life expectancy in Haiti. So it's pretty permanent. And there are people... But beyond that... The elements of the story are true. Now, people, this awful little twerp, whatever he's called, David Muir, quoted the city manager. The city manager says, nothing to see, he's doing Leslie Nielsen in Naked Gun. Nothing to see here, folks, please move along. The people on the ground are reporting their pets are going missing. They're reporting, this is how this story got out there. Ordinary people are saying that they're in Springfield, are saying that they're seeing this going on. And the city, the government is denying it. Oh, so that means we've no need to cover it. Why don't ABC, instead of just having this oleaginous little creep Muir saying, oh, no, that's not true. We've had a press release from the city manager. Why doesn't the oleaginous little creep, well, not him, he's obviously too, he's busy getting his hair blow dried, but they still have a couple of reporters there. Why don't they send any of the reporters to Springfield, Ohio? It's big on the internet. So people are talking about it. People in Springfield are talking about it. People in Springfield are going along to the city council meeting and talking about it. Nevertheless, to a certain extent, Bill has a point. You don't need the dog and cat stuff is colourful and people can grasp it. People can grasp it. There's a woman who's been charged with... I forget whether it's eating a cat or eating a dog or whatever. So people are eating domestic pets. She killed the dog or cat. She killed the cat in public and then ate the cat. But beyond that, there's an 11-year-old boy who died at the hands of one of these quote-unquote refugees. Somebody's mother-in-law was killed by one of these, quote, in Springfield, somebody's mother-in-law was killed by one of these, quote, unquote, refugees. You know, basically, the entire Democrat media campaign is a gaslighting operation to assure people that their lying eyes are lying to them all the time. But the reality of America, as I always say, is it's dying. It's going to die as a giant, brutally violent Latin American favela. On the rate of admission of unchecked, unverified people, you know, I mentioned that I'd flown in to come back for the debate. And my plane landed in Montreal, and I was met in Montreal and then driven south of the border. I was met by a United States citizen who has a Nexus card that she's used thousands of times to go back and forth across the border. Well, this time she presented the Nexus card, and the guy said, this isn't verified for land use. Well, she's used it for land use thousands and thousands of times. And he immediately starts treating her like a criminal, because as Ava said on our show, and she was quite right about this, she said it a couple of years ago on the show, and she's absolutely right. Increasingly, citizens of the West are there's no presumption of innocence. When you go through all these bollocks to just live your life now, you are assumed to be guilty. And I'm just like, I remember the words of Kipling after living in Vermont for a couple of years, that he said, Americans have thrown off a king only to prostrate themselves before the clerk of the customs house. And he was quite correct about that. I don't know where some tin-pot twerp bureaucrat gets all, you know, this card functioned perfectly normal. Oh, it's only available. You can't use it on a plane. You have to activate it for land use, according to this wanker at the border post. And I'm sitting there thinking, why is this little bit? 99% of US immigration laws are no longer applicable, but this one little sliver of a bit, one little sliver of a bureaucratic regulation is used to torment law-abiding American citizens. You're assholes for putting up with it, to be honest. Kipling's right. You know, why if you're the freest country in the history of countries, do you have to prostrate yourself before the clerk of the customs house, while millions and millions on the northern border, while millions and millions of people scoff at your laws and just walk in across the Rio Grande. And then from there on in, they are shipped, ferried deep into the heartland so that every community is a border community now. Because the last, I have no knowledge of American geography, but I have a vague memory of once looking at a map of America, and as far as I can tell, Springfield, Ohio isn't anywhere near the southern border. But its population is increased by a third, so that now the biggest demographic group in town becomes Haitian. And I said as a throwaway line that as Haiti has, I think it's the fourth highest murder rate in the world, the way to bet is that the new Haitian Haiti is the new Haitian Ohio is going to have a significantly higher homicide rate. Town of 58,000 it was, and an 11-year-old boy dead at the hands of a Haitian, somebody's mother-in-law dead at the hands of a Haitian. These things should not be happening. And they're happening because of Kamala Harris. And yeah, I sympathize with the point that Bill is making. You know, that maybe he would have been better to talk about the 11-year-old boy and the mother-in-law. Nothing good is going to come of this. You can have your nice little town, you know, and again, the virtue signaling. Three of the shishiest small towns, you know, few hundred people. Maybe I think the largest is 1,500 people or something, maybe 2,000. And they declared themselves sanctuary towns. And I said on Rush, you know, hey, if you're any MS-13 gang members listening to this, drive north from Massachusetts and go to the, take these towns up on their offer of sanctuary. They'll thank you for it. You know, real people are dying here. Yeah, the dogs and cats is like vivid and makes for good internet memes and all the rest of it. But you know what matters in the end, and they're good as just a general sign of a once great nation sinking into depravity. But he could have got in the 11-year-old boy and the mother-in-law too. These are terrible in a town of 58,000. Aaron Everett says, the debate exposes the real truth, which is that the government is so large that no one can even define what it does. It's not there for the protection of the citizen, the culture, the border, or the cats. Our government is like what's underneath a pair of bad yoga pants at Walmart. Yoga pants at Walmart. That should be the new flag. Things are technically covered and hiding what's not to be seen, but they leave nothing to the imagination. And we all know what's really there. It's pretty clear now that we're not voting our way off of this island. I think that's true. I think that's really what the Cheney... The Uniparty is a thing. And so the fact that Kamala Harris is supposed to be extreme left-wing and Cheney is supposed to be a deranged right-wing megalomaniac makes no difference in the end because they're both operating within Uniparty norms. And Trump isn't, and J.D. Vance isn't, and that's the problem with them. We're on a ride with no off button, spinning into oblivion. My question is, how do we stay positive enough to survive the decline? I don't think there's enough soma, the Aldous Huxley reference, to make it tolerable. Do you have suggestions? You don't want to be taken the soma. The government wants to feed you the soma. So they want you to think that as long as you've got your Netflix subscription or whatever, that nothing bad is. I mean, the flotsam and jetsam, the sort of hyper present tense cultural stimulation is part of their plan to keep you sufficiently anesthetized so that you don't notice it. The thing about it is, people at a certain point, a lot more so-called normies are going to have to get real. And that's the way. You don't want to survive the decline. You want to arrest the decline. You want to, because on the numbers at which these cat eaters and gang rapists and murderers are being admitted, the so-called virtue signalers are guaranteeing a perpetual hell. And it's not even that they can't even say, oh, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. This is not prudent, and it's unprecedented in the entirety of human history. I talk often about how if I'd had my way, I'd have been much happier living between 1848 and August 1914. You have to know something. I couldn't get over the way when my kids went to school in New Hampshire. They don't have history classes. It's all submerged into something called social studies, which means... Yeah, you know, they just teach a. It's it, anyway, but that's what's needed. You have to convince. Right now, the election is supposed. If you believe these polls, which I don't necessarily, but officially, the election is neck and neck. Right, That's insane. Who wanted all these millions of people? I don't want an America. I don't think, if you look at the way the acceleration of America to a land of 350 million people. And I look at the music that I play on the Serenade radio show each week. And Frank Sinatra, when he likes to sing The House I Live In, what is America to me? A land of, and he sings at one point, it's a land of 150 million people, right? 150 million people. And now it's 350 million people, and I think rather more than that. And actually, I think, you know, adding a couple of hundred million people in three quarters of a century isn't actually a good idea. And it's made the country physically a lot uglier. And just in terms of the, you know, strip malls and all the rest of it. But I don't think it's, the Constitution wasn't designed. This is another reason why the Constitution waving is so pathetic. The Constitution was designed for a small, homogenous population. You can't apply it. It won't be applicable to half a billion people. That's ridiculous. That's no, you can't, I don't believe you can have a first world country that size. Not going to happen. Mark Stein live around the planet, 20 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That's 20 to 9 British summertime. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. If you would like a break from who's up 2 points in Pennsylvania or 0.5 of a point in Michigan, don't forget the concluding episode of our current Tale for Our Time, The Flying In by G.K. Chesterton. It's more germane to the world that is just around the corner than anything you are likely to hear on cable news. The Flying In by G.K. Chesterton, the final episode, airs tonight right here at Stein Online at about 7 p.m. North American Eastern time. Let us go to William McKinney. And William says, Dear Mr. Stein, for what it's worth, I miss the music too. that's sorry to hear that. I've got, what's happened now? I've got the screen seems to be frozen on the next sentence of your letter. Let me see if I can get it. William McKinney says, Dear Mr. Stein, that's amazing. They still have frozen screens? That seems like something from AOL in the late 90s. I'll put that down in the Nothing Works Anymore files. Who was I? Oh, yeah, William McKinney. Dear Mr. Stein, for what it's worth, I miss the music too. I'm writing to ask for your thoughts on the Tucker Carlson-Daryl Cooper interview. The folks at Powerline appear to have lost their minds over it, calling Mr. Carlson a Lindbergh anti-Semite. I think it's actually only one guy over at Powerline, Scott Johnson. With plenty of bile left over for Mr. Cooper, having listened to the interview and to Mr. Cooper's response on the Martyr Made podcast, I just don't understand the intensity of the reaction to the interview. Neither do I think either man an anti-Semite. Perhaps I am wrong, but I think Dick Cheney voting for the American Communist Party this November is what should really be animating the right, not this. Israel Pickholtz also says, Mark, what do you have to say about your buddy Tucker and his new friend Daryl Cooper? Otherwise, normal people seem headed off the deep end. Candace Owens has already, in extreme fashion, not like Cheney, but in ways that are truly troubling. Keep the embers burning. And Sarah Whitehead, where's the other one? I thought that we had a... Oh, here it is, yeah, from Commander. Tucker Carlson has recently come under criticism for failing to counter the anti-Semitic statements of Daryl Cooper and Candace Owens, both of whom he hosted on his show. I do not think that you are an anti-Semite. Relatively speaking, is Tucker Carlson one? Well, October the 7th is last year's when we're coming up to the first anniversary of what really happened to get this current thing going. And I wrote about it then. I commented on it then, just in a rather general way. I think, you know, we quoted a G.K. Chesterton thing about barbarians. And for me, the Israel thing is primarily that I'm on the side of the civilized over the barbarians. So when guys come parachuting in to a peace and love festival and they kill all the guys and they seize the women and then they rape them as they're taking them back across the border to Gaza, and then they kill them. And we covered some of these stories in the early weeks after October the 7th. They're still killing them because that's what they do. Because the Hamas can't build anything. They're not even, like, as I've said for many decades, they're not even like, if they were a nationalist movement, they would have a nation by now. This isn't about land or anything. It's about Jew killing. That's the position I have always held on that. I would like it. It's not like going to Bosnia, where there are different groups that happen to disagree, and one wants to be top dog, and one another group would prefer to be top dog itself. You can see that all over the map, where there are intractable disputes. Until eventually I come home to Quebec, and Quebec secessionists want to leave the country they're in to set up another country exactly like it. And so I've seen all this stuff all over the world, and there's nothing like these guys who just are in the business of Jew killing. And I would make another point on that I think it depends. And again, this is where the bungling of the war on terror by chumps like Cheney and Bush has queered everything. Because I think the Israelis benefited 20 years ago from the fact that people in America saw the Israelis as basically being in a situation analogous to them, as indeed the Buddhists in southern Thailand are, as indeed the Christians in Nigeria are, as indeed Australian nightclubbers in Bali were. It's Islam versus your team here. And that was how it was written about, that these people that the pathologies that were visible on October the 7th are also available in a park in Annecy in eastern France when some guy decides to stab all the kids. pardon me, my voice is very weak today. And if you see the so-called Palestine situation as analogous to what is being done to French school children, Australian nightclubbers, Buddhists in southern Thailand, Christians in Nigeria, it becomes a lot easier to talk sense about it. Now with Tucker's show, I didn't see the show. I have no desire to see the show, and I haven't been able to return to Tucker because of my health issues. But I will say, you know, what I always loved about Tucker's show was the monologues. And if you watched his when it was on Fox, and if you watched his show when it was on Fox, he'd do a 20-minute monologue, Mead Cooper,
whom I've talked about. She's one of the 10 most powerful women in American broadcasting or whatever. And she runs Fox's primetime thing. And I remember her saying to an associate of mine, I guess it was in the form of a heads up when I was hosting one week or something. She said she thought sometimes Tucker's monologue went a little long, but that was the show. That the show, he'd do a 20-minute monologue, and then he'd do 3-minute interviews for the rest of the hour. And I preferred, I preferred that format. I liked the way, I think it's Suzanne Scott, who's the president at Fox, said to me that that's the most important bit of the show. That the audience wants to hear what you think about whatever the big issue is before they meet the guests. And I, and for whatever reason, Tucker doesn't seem to be doing much of that. Now, I've never heard of this guy, this historian. And I'm just speaking here as an old school British imperialist, because I've got three questions here all about the anti-Semitism of this particular edition of the show. What was interesting to me, from my point of view, is the anti-imperialism of that show. I don't think Churchill. So I don't think Churchill was the villain of the Second World War. I think he made the decision to fight on when he became prime minister after the fall of France. You know, there were plans to evacuate the royal family to Canada and have them live in Rideau Hall in Ottawa and all the rest of it. And Churchill took the decision to fight on. And as you know, until America joined the war at the time of Pearl Harbor, basically the British Empire stood alone. And I think that was a good thing. Because all this explanation that Chumpy McArspants, or whatever the historian's name is, they captured so many people in the East that the humane thing to do was to kill them all. It wasn't like that, though. They took people in Western France and put them on trains to the camps, civilians. They didn't have to capture them. They weren't fighting them or anything. They just happened to be Jews being a bit too Jewy for the occupiers' taste. And so they wound up getting shipped east to the camps. The idea that this is just some bureaucratic mismanagement, there are elements of that, because Germany was a highly developed bureaucracy by the standards of the time. So you knew that if they came up with a bureaucratic plan, which is what it was, to kill millions of people, they would do it extremely well. But so I don't agree with any of that, and I don't at heart think that Tucker agrees with it. But he has his, you know, he has his foibles. He's rather anti-Canadian, and he's a bit anti-British, at least old school British. I remember I was asking him what he was reading one time, and he was reading some book about how the concentration camps are the invention of the British in the Boer War in South Africa, which is true to a certain extent. But this is, you know, you should certainly be. I'm pro Churchill. Because I think he was the indispensable man at the hinge moment of the 20th century. And I wouldn't want to live, you know, if you ask me whether I want to live under Clement Attlee and Winston Churchill and Anthony Eden and Harold Macmillan and the 14th Earl of Hume and Harold Wilson, or would I rather live under the local version of the Third Reich? I don't find that a difficult call. Now, the thing, what we, the the reframing is going on because people feel the second, everything has been crap since the Second World War. And in particular, since the Second World War, nationalism, I mean, if you look at the way the AfD victories in Germany were portrayed as the first victory by the far right in the first electoral victory by the far right in a German state since the Nazi era. That's how the BBC reported the AfD victories. So they feel the whole anti-Hitler thing is a way of doing down the conventional nationalist, ethno-nationalist parties in Europe and America and elsewhere. And that's certainly true. So people want to, the idea of continuously invoking the Second World War as an argument for globalism and against nationalism is a valid one, it seems to me. And I was struck by one other thing too during the most recent D-Day commemorations. In contrast to the ones from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, is that the veterans themselves overwhelmingly dislike the country they fought to save, whether you're talking about Britain or whether you're talking about France or whether you're talking about Canada or whatever. So these veterans, the people who fought and defeated the Axis in World War II, generally, once you sort of press them on the point, dislike the world they are living in now, and they regard it as a betrayal of their comrades' sacrifice. And I certainly think one should be allowed to talk about that. But that's not anything that Churchill, there's memoranda from when he was back in government in 1951, there's memoranda about concern for immigration from the British West Indies. I don't think, you know, Churchill I regard as a character. After Gallipoli, he resigned from the cabinet because he felt some responsibility for it. And his ambition, which is a rather charming one, was to become governor of British East Africa, a post one holds in conjunction with being British High Commissioner in Zanzibar, one being a colony, the other being a protectorate. And Asquith nixed that. He wouldn't let it. So he wouldn't let it go on. So instead, Churchill, in his 40s, returned to active service in the British Army and fought on the Belgian front, fought in Flanders during the First World War. I mean, that's it. Can you imagine that now? Can you imagine any of these complete Boris Johnson, who's presented to us as Churchillian, when he was forced out of Number 10, did he say, "Oh, I'm going to join. I'm going to go off and actually, I'm going to fight on the Ukrainian front"? No. Compared to people who we have now, he wasn't trusted. He changed parties too often. The king initially didn't like him at the start of the Second World War, but he was an admirable man. So I don't think this guy knows anything. And again, this idea of absolving, you know, I don't want to get in. It's not about history. It's about anti-Semitism, not in the context of Churchill's era, not in the context of the Balfour Declaration or the creation of the State of Israel. It's anti-Semitism because it's designed to do down the people running Israel today. And Tucker's quite clear on that. I don't think it necessarily makes him an anti-Semite, but he doesn't want, he doesn't want America being involved in anything that's going on in Gaza or in Ukraine. And I don't either. Because if you like Palestinians, or you like Israelis, or you like the Ukrainians, or you like the Russians, right now in Ukraine, it's America that's keeping the war going. And in the Gaza situation, it would not help if you're on the side of the Israelis. You do not want the beribboned buffoons of the Pentagon having anything to do with it. I'm in favor. You know, I read those posts over at Powerline, and the idea that people need to ostracize Tucker, people need to... I don't get that. I used to go on shows hosted by people hostile to me all the time. I used to go, there was some guy in the comments the other day saying, oh, so you went in and talked with Dick Cheney about the demographic thesis of America Alone. Does that mean you're part of the Uniparty too? No, I used to go in and see all kinds of people about my demographic thesis. I saw members of Tony Blair's cabinet, for example, with which I didn't agree. I saw Kevin Rudd. Kevin Rudd asked to see me, have a meeting, the Labour leader and subsequently Prime Minister in Australia. Now, I don't agree with anything Kevin Rudd says, and he has some rather revolting personal habits as well. I mentioned once that I was sitting next to him. It was done alphabetically at this conference in Australia. So I had Kevin Rudd on my left and Malcolm Turnbull on my right, with whom I don't disagree, with whom I disagree on many, many things. But at least he didn't do that thing that Kevin Rudd did, where he reaches over on my plate and picks up bits of my food with his fingers, the same fingers with which he's been picking his earwax and then eating it. But Kevin Rudd's personal disgusting habits aside, I was happy. He's a powerful figure in Australian politics. I was happy to go and talk to him. I talked to all kinds of people, left and right. And I think one should have, you know, the criticism of Tucker is that it's not that he was wrong to have this guy on, but that he appeared to agree with the guy. And I don't know that. I haven't seen the show. I haven't got time to see the show. I'm in very poor health, and I have to think about how I use my time. Basically, my doctors think I should only be doing the Serenade radio show, and all the rest is just shortening my life. But I'm not... I agreed with someone who thought this was like the right 1619 moment. You know, it's a conscious effort, this, to reframe the American story. And the thing about it is that maybe it does need reframing, because this is where the whole idea of, the Second World War is central to the idea of America as the global policeman and all the rest of it. If it weren't for us, you'd be speaking German and all that kind of thing. But I don't. Tucker is on the move, and I understand that, because he's been on the move since 9/11, because nothing the Republican establishment does has worked. Candace Owens is different, I think. I mean, that her anti-Semitism, it goes along with this thing that the real Brigitte Macron died years ago and was replaced by her brother in drag. And I have minimal contact with that level of French politics, but I happen to disagree. I happen to disagree with that. I think, well, let me put it this way. I've gone on a bit too long. I think Candace Owens is antipathetic to Jews, doesn't really like Jews. I think Nick Fuentes, who does oven jokes, I think Gavin McInnes's producer, who that synagogue in Philadelphia, where there was the shooting, And he tweeted, Gavin McInnes's producer tweeted that 6 million people had died in the synagogue. Yeah, I think there is anti-Semitism on the right, in part as a reaction to the stupidity of the official Jews in America and Canada and Britain, who are always gatekeeping. You know, the official Jews were the most opposed to me during the free speech battles. They made common cause. A complete wanker called Bernie Faber, who's head of the Canadian Jewish Congress, and he made common cause with the Canadian Islamic Congress. He's there schmoozing the guys who were suing me. And now there's sudden, and the same with the guy Horse Feathers that appeared, whatever he's called, House Father, that appeared in the Canadian Parliament before. And now he's shocked. He's shocked that there's all this anti-Semitism all over Montreal, and Bernie Faber is shocked that it's all over Toronto. You brought these people in, you complete pillocks. You screwed any future for Jews in the Dominion of Canada. That's on you, asshole. I mean, it should be, this is, again, the people need to find a way to piss all over the official, the Anti-Defamation League, who think that when, Toulouse, it's terrible, people are shooting up the Jewish school. Oh, gosh, it must be a resurgence of neo-Nazis in Toulouse. You complete prick. Have you never been to Toulouse? You know, hath not a Jew eyes? It's people are annoyed about it. People correctly feel that the quote-unquote official Jews, I think that's my friend Ezra Levant's term for them, and I remember when they basically took the side of the Canadian Islamic Congress that my books should be banned, Ezra taunted them. We were in the lobby of of Parliament in Ottawa, and he taunted them as Jewish book burners. You know, so people, there's something bad is happening because Jews are being expunged. Simply, they're being overwhelmed demographically by the importation of all these Muslims. Nobody's going to take the side of a Jew. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom's wife, Lady Starmer, is Jewish and is raising their children as Jews. Nobody mentions that. And she doesn't go out campaigning with him. Not just when they're in the Islamic parts of the UK, but in the other parts too. And Tucker, compared to the demographic arithmetic in Michigan and in Toronto and in Rotterdam and in Marseille, Tucker's thing is, you know, small potatoes. I don't think this guy, Daryl Cooper, that's his name. Daryl Cooper, I'm just looking at the emails again. I don't think he knows anything. I certainly don't think he understands the particular choices that were available to the British government after basically the entire continent had been taken over by Germany. But the idea that he's the villain of the second, and this again that he's put in power by Zionist financiers, you know. This is none of this. That's truer of, you know, whoever put Rishi Sunak in power. He was someone that this is how insane the world has become now. That Churchill is Hitler and Hitler is Churchill. And I'm all for revisionism, but that one isn't going to fly. Sarah Whitehead says, greetings from Sydney. I always enjoy listening to you every week and miss your slot on GB News, which has gone downhill since you left. What are your thoughts on this? There are council elections here this coming Saturday. However, someone in the Liberal Party office, now this Liberals in the Australian system, the Liberals are the right-wing party because they mean liberal in the sense of a 19th century Manchester Liberal or a classical Liberal. So that's the right-wing party. That's the party of John Howard and Tony Abbott and whatnot. However, someone in the Liberal Party office missed a form deadline a few weeks ago, and so they are not on the ballot. This has happened to 200-plus councillors in New South Wales. My options to vote for, who to vote for, are the Greens, Labour, or the incumbent woke independent party. As it is compulsory to vote here, I shall have to spoil my ballot paper. Now, that's very interesting, because that's perfect. You know, when we talk about the Uniparty, New South Wales has taken it to the next level. Because you have compulsory voting, but you only have left-wing parties to vote for. So you've got the Greens, you've got the Labour Party, and you've got the Wokey Party. And so then the question arises, did they really just accidentally miss this ballot filing deadline so they can't have any candidates? Or is this what they're going to do? You know, I noticed the same thing in America where... RFK Jr. has suspended his campaign and is supporting Trump. But even though he's withdrawn, Michigan has ruled that he's got to stay on the ballot. You know, these are not functioning. Churchill used to say democracy was the worst form of government except for all the others. Well, now, increasingly, it's looking like the worst form of government because it's incapable of offering the citizenry the ability to exercise self-government or responsible government in a meaningful way. And, you know, as bad as the Australian Liberal Party is it really so incompetent that an entire state's only right of centre party can be sufficiently incompetent as to miss a filing deadline for its entire slate of candidates? Odd. Johnny Woodrow says, Dear Mark, Andrew Neil is looking for a job now that the owner of the Tories and Trivia channel has bought a comic book to add to his portfolio of media platforms that say nothing of importance. This is a reference to Sir Paul Marshall, who was at one point chairman of GB News, I think after Andrew Neil flounced off in a big Queenie Huff. And Sir Paul Marshall became chairman. I remember I had breakfast with him at the Carlton Club in London shortly thereafter. And that's really my only... aside from a few emails, my only real contact with him. And he's just bought The Spectator, the magazine, one I used to write for. And Johnny Woodrow continues, does the old vax pusher, Andrew Neil, have a future in the mainstream media, or has he now got nowhere to go with the woke to his left and the trivia merchants to his right? What does the story of Andrew Neil tell us about journalism today? Well, I wouldn't go that far. He lives in the south of France. I used to do running jokes on GB News about him being on the nude beach at Saint-Tropez all day. Which he's not. I don't believe he's actually on the nude beach at Saint-Tropez all day long. He's like a mile and a half away up in the hills. I don't know that he's sufficiently unusual Don't forget, he was part of the crowd that he was the guy Rupert entrusted to set up Fox News, and that then Rupert worried that he wasn't up to it, and he installed Roger Ailes instead, the guy who launched and built Fox News. And Rupert, once he takes against you, it's permanent. There's no comeback. Rupert was at one point asked whether he wanted to, rather than start a rival channel of his own, was asked if he'd like to become the majority owner in GB News. And the GB News guys had a big meeting with Rupert, and Rupert said, well, you know, my one condition would be, this was while Andrew Neil was still on board, and he said, well, Andrew Neil couldn't be part of it. So he can bear a grudge over many decades. Johnny concludes, P.S., your reading of The Flying Inn has been the highlight of my year, and I've had a really great year so far. I've decided to stop reading current affairs stuff until I've worked my way through Chesterton. I think then I'll be able to come back to the mad world with some sanity. Well, The Flying Inn, my audio serialization of that, concludes this evening, so don't miss that. Alex from America, don't know whether that's a boy, Alex, or a girl, Alex, or... Not that it matters these days, but I've no idea what Alex's pronouns are. Alex says, recently the FBI announced an investigation involving various content providers allegedly taking money from the Russians. At least one, I believe, is a former colleague of yours from CRTV, now Blaze. What do you make of this? This is a reference to... I forget that. What's it called? This company. I forget what it's called. But it's set up by Lauren Chen and her husband. And Lauren Chen was one of the several people that they CRTV, Carrie Katz, the Cockwomble, replaced me with. Now the Department of Justice has indicted two Russia Today employees over this. And they don't seem terribly important enough to merit the spotlight that's being beamed on this particular case, because the only two people indicted are these Russia Today employees. The nub of the crime is that these Russia Today guys gave $10 million to Lauren Chen and her husband, I think the guy is, in order to influence American politics. But interesting, and they say that Lauren Chen and her husband should have registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act or whatever. But oddly enough, and again, this is the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice. And there's something a little illogical if you accept that on the January 6th prosecutions, they're basically totalitarian enforcers of a one-party state, but then say, oh, on the other hand, when they indict over the $10 million to some third-rate blowhard YouTuber that Carrie Katz, and they're Canadian too, by the way, these two. But the interesting thing is, whatever crimes the Russians committed, Lauren Chen and her husband also committed. And yet they have not been indicted. So the reasonable conclusion, if you talk to anybody in federal law enforcement, is that Lauren and her husband turned Fed's evidence and agreed to cooperate with the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice. Which means that the Department of Justice, 2 months out from, or however long ago this goes that they turned these guys, 6 months back, backdoored their way into the... Because all the people that... worked for this Lauren Chen, took the Russian money, all now say, oh, this is the first I've heard of it. I didn't know about any of it at all. They include people like Tim Pool and Dave Rubin. There's other people who thought it all sounded suspicious from the get-go, like Sebastian Gorka, who said it all smelt iffy, and so he steered clear. But what it means is that the feds have backdoored their way into the emails and texts of almost everyone who matters on the American right. If you add up the things she is mixed up with, the CRTV and the YouTube thing and everything, it means they're in the texts and emails of Dave Rubin and Mark Levin and Glenn Beck. That was the deal. I'm just stating the obvious here. I would also say with Lauren Chen, she had a small part to play in one of my the suits that Katz filed against me, because as part of our contract, the Stein Show set was not allowed to be used by anybody else. They wound up installing the Stein Show fireplace in her studio, and she used it, and it was driven across the border to Montreal, which is where she was broadcasting from, and I don't believe they ever declared that to Her Majesty's government, as it was then. But you know, this is the problem here, that if you get an offer, you know, if you get an offer to make some YouTube videos and you're being offered $1 million a year, and you're not curious about the way that where that money's coming from, and it's coming from someone who has, they haven't even bothered to create a fake internet profile for him. As I said, the DOJ is corrupt. So the obvious thing and the obvious reason why Lauren Chen hasn't been charged, although she's lost her show with Carrie Katz, she's lost her platform on YouTube and all the rest of it. But the obvious reason is because she turned feds evidence and helped the feds backdoor their way into the texts and emails of every person of influence on the American right. And that's where I think we're going to leave it for today on that particular thought. This has been Mark Stein live around the planet. That is going to do it for today. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. And don't forget, coming up in just a couple of hours, right here, the grand finale of our nightly Tale for Our Time, Chesterton's The Flying Inn. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, come on in. The water's fine. We've got all kinds of delights, including my weekend music show coming up this Saturday. And don't forget, if you don't fancy it yourself, for the Stein Shy Chum in your life, there's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe, stay free, stay well.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.